government regulations, which were created to protect employees, are actually hurting them.
Regulation after regulation.
Until the government understands that they have to create an environment suitable for us to keep growing, we're going to stay in this recession a long time.
The federal government has blocked efforts to expand the ride-sharing.
The owners say the restaurant has succumbed to the crush of government regulations.
We have seen an unprecedented explosion of new regulatory activity.
$1.8 trillion. That's how much business
and bus companies to close.
I think there are outdated regulations that need to be changed. There is red tape that needs to be cut.
The regulations are...
There's a regulation that doesn't make any sense. Why do you keep...
Is this really the best we can do?
This is Free Lunch, the podcast of the Federalist Society's Regulatory Transparency Project. All expressions of opinion on this podcast are those of the speakers.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another Federalist Society Free Lunch podcast call for the Regulatory Transparency Project. Visit the RTP website at regproject.org, regproject.org, to subscribe to our newsletter and to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. My name is Devin Westhill. I'm the director of the RTP and the host of the Free Lunch Podcast. This Free Lunch Podcast explores the question, is the Food and Drug Administration's rule on cigars and vaping products constitutional? I refer to the omnibus rule issued by the FDA in 2016, apparently pursuant to the Tobacco Control Act that regulates cigars, pipe tobacco, and vaping products. That rule required all of these products to go through an FDA review process similar to that for prescription pharmaceuticals and medical devices, and also to bear large warnings in its advertisements. The guests on our podcast today say that this rule raises various issues, including weighty First Amendment and Article 2, Section 2 Appointments Clause constitutional issues. Without further ado, let me introduce our guests, Michael Edney and Todd Gaziano. Mike is chairman of Norton Rose Fulbright's White Collar Criminal Defense Practice Group and partner in its Washington office. He guides clients through all aspects of government regulation, criminal and regulatory investigations, and civil litigation. Mike has represented clients before all manner of government entities, including the Departments of Justice, Treasury, State, Commerce, Defense, HHS, SEC, CFTC, NSA, and congressional committees. Mike's practice draws on previous government experience. From 2007 to 2009, he served as a legal advisor to the National Security Council at the White House, and from 2005 to 2007, Mike served in the DOJ's Office of Legal Counsel. Todd Gaziano is an attorney and the director of the Center for the Separation of Powers at the Pacific Legal Foundation. He joined PLF in 2014 and previously served as executive director of its D.C. Center and senior fellow in constitutional law. Todd has served in all three branches of the federal government and has worked in the private sector. His public law work includes service as a law clerk for U.S. Fifth Circuit Judge Edith Jones and DOJ's Office of Legal Counsel, as a chief subcommittee counsel in the U.S. House of Representatives, and as the founding director of the Heritage Foundation's Legal Center. He also had a six-year term as commissioner on the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights. He was a frequent legal commentator in print, on radio, and TV before congressional committees and in other public settings. He regularly publishes scholarly papers and op-eds on constitutional and legal reform topics. Several of his scholarly articles have influenced landmark Supreme Court litigation, congressional policy, and presidential actions. And we're very happy here at the Federal Society to have Todd participate as a member of the RTP's Regulatory Process Working Group. Much more could be said about both of our guests today, but I'll leave it there for now. If you'd like to learn more about Mike or Todd, please visit regproject.org. Okay, we're almost to the good stuff, folks. Let me first remind everyone that the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy initiatives, and therefore all expressions of opinion on Free Lunch Podcasts are those of our featured speakers. Our guests will take questions after their remarks, so please be prepared with any questions that you might have prior to the start of our Q&A period. Alrighty, gentlemen, thank you both for participating in today's Free Lunch Podcast. Now, how about we start with this, Mike. Mike, can you describe the background of the rule that I referenced earlier in my remarks, its content, summarize the litigation perhaps, litigation history, and let us know what the new administration's proposed reconsideration is of some of those aspects?
Thank you, Devin. I'd be happy to, and thanks very much for having us. Back in the summer of 2016, just before the end of the last administration, but unfortunately just early enough to avoid the Congressional Review Act, the FDA came out with what's called the deeming rule. This is a rule that came under the Family Smoking Prevention and Tobacco Control Act of 2009. It set up a extensive regulatory regime for cigarettes and smokeless tobacco and authorized the FDA to deem other tobacco products subject to the act, and that's exactly what the agency did. It dumped all of cigars, all of pipe tobacco, and all of the e-cigarette products that Todd is going to talk about in a moment into the cigarette regulatory regime. This regime treats these products just like prescription drugs or medical devices, requires the manufacturers of these products to register, to submit extensive internal paperwork and ingredient information, and perhaps most importantly, imposes a massive pre-market review process on each of these products. Strangely enough, the Act grandfathered all cigarette products that were on the market before 2007, but the FDA in its deeming rule, when it put cigars and pipe tobacco and vaping products into the pre-market review process, kept that 2007 date. So the grandfathering didn't reach nearly 10 years of products that were already on the marketplace, and all of those have to go through an extensive extensive pre-market review process that includes testing and scientific information. They have to show that they're substantially equivalent to a pre-2017 predicate. And for vaping products, as Todd will discuss in a moment, that's going to be very difficult to do because these are entirely new products. If they don't prove that, they have to go through something that's almost akin to like a phase three trial for prescription medication. This process made a bunch of sense for cigarettes because there were allegations of product manipulation, nicotine levels, and other chemicals that the law was designed to address. But there, for these products, especially cigars and pipe tobacco, there was no such allegation of nicotine manipulation. That many of these cigars have been made the same way as they have been for half a millennium. When it comes to premium cigars, they're all made by hand, and that created a particular problem because there's fewer than 100 major cigarette products on the marketplace, but there are nearly 20,000 premium cigar products on the marketplace because, you know, you just go into any tobacconist, there's different varietals, different years, different blends, different wrappers. None of these really affect public health issues, but each of these has to go through, you know, the very same process that a massive cigarette brand has to, and much of this premium cigar industry is not prepared to handle that. The rule also imposes massive warnings on cigar, pipe tobacco, and vaping products. They have to cover 30% of two panels of each box, and 20% of all advertisements, which the FDA has really interpreted to include just about any communication with a consumer. The administration, you know, my clients in Washington, D.C., sued the FDA about this rule. The administration had the rule on the books, but they delayed compliance with it a couple times in response to our lawsuit. And then in July 2017, they announced a delay in compliance with some of the major requirements of the rule, including the pre-market review requirement for 3.5 years. That was meant to accommodate a rulemaking that would determine whether premium cigars should be regulated differently. That rulemaking was just opened last week, along with two other rulemakings to perhaps regulate the level of nicotine in cigarettes directly. That's a big deal for the cigarette industry and the use of flavored additive flavors in any tobacco product. Despite these delays, the administration left the warnings requirement in place, and that goes into effect for, you know, the premium cigar boxes that you see in your high-end tobacco store in August of 2018. Various cigar companies are challenging those requirements under the First Amendment. We represent two groups of these companies. one in litigation in Washington, D.C., where the case has been argued in December and we're awaiting decision on our motion for summary judgment and preliminary injunction. Another group of independent clients in the Eastern District of Texas, and I'll discuss the theories that are proceeding in those cases in a few moments. The anti-tobacco groups, including the American Cancer Society, have just last week challenged the 3.5-year extension I referred to on some aspects of the rule as not going through the notice and comment process. That lawsuit was filed in the District of Maryland a few days ago. And that's where we are. The administration, is taking a hard look at many aspects of the rule, but actually some of the aspects that are most legally vulnerable, including the warnings issue with all its First Amendment problems. The administration is defending that one, and that's one of the few regulations the administration is defending. So it provides a unique opportunity to go up against the administration in court on an anti-regulatory issue. I'll turn it back over to you, Devin.
Well, thanks for the introduction, Mike, and I want to just clarify. You mentioned that you represent some organizations or groups that are challenging this rule. What you mean by that is Norton Rose Fulbright. I mean, Todd's not involved in that litigation, correct?
Oh yeah, I guess I was I guess I was using the wrong pronoun. Yeah, I am, and my law firm is. So Todd, and I think he's going to talk about it in a moment, has mounted a challenge to this rule on behalf of the vaping industry through the Pacific Legal Foundation.
Okay, good. Yeah, just for clarity. And okay, so Todd is involved in some lawsuits, however. And Todd, could you discuss that? Maybe discuss what the issue is with the appointments clause, what that problem is?
Sure. Thanks, Devin. I want to thank you as well for putting this together and moderating it for us. We represent Pacific Legal Foundation. I'm on the team that is for Pacific Legal Foundation, representing 9 different plaintiffs in 3 different lawsuits. We filed on January 30th in Minnesota, Minneapolis, Dallas, and D.C., and you note that those are in 3 different circuits. We're so confident of our legal theory, we want to get to the Supreme Court if we don't win before then. But let me just very briefly note that we're representing 8 of our clients are vaping retailers. So while we hope the whole vaping industry supports us, we're not representing manufacturers of vaping equipment. We're just representing the mom and pop retailers and one harm reduction group in our Minnesota litigation. And I may touch on this the second time. I think Devin has an outline for us on the harm reduction issue, but let me introduce it very briefly. Some of our clients got in the business because vaping helped them quit smoking. And there is one peer-reviewed medical study, there are several, but the one that I have in mind suggests that it's the most effective way for smokers to quit smoking. Vaping, of course, has a battery that heats a coil and vaporizes liquid. That liquid, in almost every instance, is not derived from tobacco at all and has varying levels of nicotine, and this is what helps smokers quit smoking. But the medical study I referenced suggested that if vaping were not killed, and this rule that we're challenging is putting such strain on the vaping retailers that it could kill the industry, but that vaping could lead to 6 million saved lives. And one final just factual distinction is that vapers, of course, can get nicotine to help them get off the smoking habit. But then there are liquids that have reduced amounts of nicotine, and the vapers who enjoy it or have the oral satisfaction of vaping can actually go to 0% nicotine. So some vaping and some vaping liquids have, and even for first-time vapers, can have they almost all have zero tobacco. They all have zero smoke and zero carcinogens related to the tar and smoke, and some even have zero nicotine. Now let me tell you about the constitutional problem. 42 years to the day prior to us filing our three lawsuits for our clients, the Supreme Court in Buckley versus Vallejo clearly stated that rulemaking is issuing rules is one of those things that only officers of the United States can do. And lo and behold, we determined that the person who issued the proposed and final rule for FDA, her name is Leslie Cook, so I'm not sure how it's pronounced, K-U-X, is not an officer of the United States. She has a reasonably high-level sounding job. She's a high SEF career staffer. She's associate commissioner for policy. In fact, she's issued about 210 of the FDA's last major rules. So, in other words, FDA hasn't issued a constitutional rule, at least any that she has issued, in a very long time. To further explain one other aspect of our complaint, and any of the listeners should go to Pacific Legal Foundation's website, pacificlegal.org, and you can find this case amongst our case list. And we one of our nicknames for it is Constitutional Rules for Rulemakers. And the whole theory behind our lawsuit on behalf of our clients, but for the public interest in general, is that it's unconstitutional for the agency to delegate its law, its rulemaking power that the Supreme Court says must be exercised by an officer to employees. In this case, we also noted in the complaint that there was a clear line of delegation from the HHS secretary that had the authority under the Tobacco Control Act to the FDA commissioner. And then the FDA commissioner, in writing, delegated authority to the office holder in the office that Leslie Cooks is filling to not only just, you know, process rules and submit them to the Federal Register, but to actually issue rules. And our complaint alleges that that's, in fact, what she did, and that's the unconstitutional step. One final thought for Appointments Clause nerds out there, and we hope everyone in the society is one. I certainly have been for a long time, since I was at OLC, where Mike once worked. We further allege that based on case law since Buckley versus Vallejo, that rulemaking must be done by a principal officer. So Leslie Cooks, who's issued the last 200 or so major rules of FDA, is just an employee. She's neither an inferior officer or a principal officer. But both the FDA commissioner and the secretary of HHS are indeed principal officers who are nominated by the president and confirmed by the Senate. One of the bases for our arguing this is in line with a few recent Supreme Court concurrences and a D.C. Circuit case. It looks at whether a supervisor can actually supervise the particular decision at issue. For example, some ALJs' decisions can be overturned. There's a Supreme Court case that raises this issue right now, Lucia, and some ALJs' decisions cannot be reviewable by a higher departmental official. Well, as FedSoc members know, and fans of the Regulatory Transparency Act especially may know, Regular Transparency Project know, once a rule is issued, even the president cannot just reverse it without going through another rulemaking. So that is our principal argument for saying that rulemaking not only must be signed off and we need to know that an officer is accountable, but we need to know that a principal officer is. So that is the goal of our appointment clause challenge. And we hate this rule too on behalf of our client for reasons that I may explain in the next round.
Well, thanks, Todd. That's a fascinating legal theory. And more importantly, I like the sound of a Regulatory Transparency Act. Maybe we should talk more about that.
Certainly.
In any event, Mike, Todd's touched slightly on this, and you touched a little bit more on this in your initial remarks, but I was hoping that we could dive a little bit deeper and get from you a description of the basic First Amendment issues or problems that you're facing with your clients in terms of the deeming rule.
Yeah, absolutely, Devin. As I mentioned before, the rule, this wasn't really mandated by statute. The agency took it upon itself to do this. Required massive warnings on cigar, pipe tobacco, and vaping products. And I think Todd will touch on that more in a moment. The government requires all sorts of commercial disclosures on the products we buy. You look at the side of your cereal box or your cleaning products, you'll see things that the government requires the company to say, but they're relatively unintrusive on the side of the box. These cigar warnings are not those. They are required to cover 30% of the two principal panels of each package in huge black font on a white background. And when you look at these things, I wish we had a picture of them and the message that came out. It becomes apparent that the dominant message on our products, if this rule were to stand, is going to be the government's message about what it believes that are their negative health effects. This is not the first time the FDA has gone down this road with regard to tobacco products. In 2005 and 2006, they promulgated a rule requiring large warnings on the covering 50% of the front panel of cigarette packages. There are large graphic warnings. The D.C. Circuit struck those down primarily on grounds that combined with their size and their graphics, they weren't just conveying information. They weren't purely factual and controversial, but instead were a form of government advocacy that were subject to stronger constitutional scrutiny. The legal framework with regard to these compelled commercial disclosures is set forth in a Supreme Court case called Zotterer. That's with a Z. The court held there that if you have a commercial disclosure that's purely factual and uncontroversial, and we would argue is directed at consumer deception, although that's not what the D.C. Circuit thinks, then that disclosure is going to be upheld if it's justified and not unduly burdensome. In the D.C. litigation, we say that these warnings are exactly unduly burdensome. They are because they're too big. A panel of the Ninth Circuit, which is now under review by the en banc court, struck down a San Francisco ordinance that required health disclosures on 20% of all advertisements regarding sugared beverages as too large. We say that Zotterer does draw a line. It may permit the disclosure of purely factual and controversial information and has to be done in a relatively unintrusive way, and this certainly doesn't count. And I think one of the things to keep in mind here is that it's not just the packages, it's really any communication with consumers, so it's any advertisement. So if you've ever been into a premium cigar store and go into one of their humidors, you'll see the packages themselves. You'll see signs describing the qualities of the product, the taste profile of the product, the heritage of the product. You'll see clocks and posters, about particular brands, and all of those have to bear these large warnings. So, really, when you walk into the normal retail store now, if this rule to go forward, it's going to turn into a museum of government speech. That's going to be the predominant message that's conveyed in your normal retail store. In the D.C. Circuit, we also say, and the D.C. Circuit has suggested that you need a substantial interest to require one of these, even if it's not preventing consumer deception. And in the tobacco warnings cases, they said, the cigarette warnings cases, they said, look, it's just not good enough to say you want to improve information flow or get better quality information out there. You need to show that your warnings are directed at reducing tobacco use. And the amazing thing about this rule is that the agency never bothered to make that showing, and never really studied the issue. And that's even more amazing because seven of the largest cigar manufacturers for 16 years have been required to put these warnings on their packages with very similar content, except they're about 80% smaller. And the agency didn't even bother to show that those weren't getting the job done, or that there was a gap in consumer understanding about the health effects of smoking cigars, even with those warnings out on much of the marketplace. We also argued that given that prior regime with the Federal Trade Commission, the rule is essentially operating as a restriction of speech. It's making the same warnings larger, and you know, what's the net effect of that? The net effect of that is to crowd out our speech, make sure that the government's message is the predominant message on the package, that their communication prevails. And we say that should be evaluated not just as a compelled commercial disclosure, but as a restriction on commercial speech. It'd be evaluated under the Central Hudson analysis, and there's really no way the government can satisfy Central Hudson on this record. They made no effort to do so in the rule. They made no effort to show that these warnings were, you know, necessary, or that there was even a need to fill a gap in information among consumers. They engaged in no analysis of less restrictive alternatives. In the Texas case, we're representing a different group of plaintiffs. These plaintiffs, none of them had ever had to bear any kind of warnings, you know, no matter what size, through the Federal Trade Commission regime or otherwise, and they are taking issue with the substance of the warnings. They say that the warnings are not purely factual and controversial, but instead they're misleading. While it's very dangerous to get into a science fight with the Food and Drug Administration, the Food and Drug Administration has been doing our work for us. Several of their staff members have published peer review articles over the last few months demonstrating that these premium cigar products, as you might imagine, aren't used like cigarettes. They're used pretty infrequently. The median consumer of premium cigars smokes 1.7 days a month. And they have engaged in extensive studies showing that if you use a cigar less frequently than daily, they can't detect a statistically significant increase in dying from tobacco-related diseases. And in that context, we say putting something that's so big on the box that is unqualified and says it increases your risk of cancer and heart disease is incomplete and misleading, and the constitutional violation is made worse because the statute, now that we're deemed subject to it, prohibits any cigar manufacturer or pipe tobacco manufacturer from really making a claim about the health effects of their products. So you can't get in a situation where the government says this, but you know it's more complicated than that. We're really banned from making those type of clarifications, and the government's message has to stand on its own. And against the science that the FDA is publishing recently, we say that it can't. This is a great opportunity to really have the courts put some teeth into the constitutional restrictions on compelled commercial disclosures. You know, the FDA says that our products are just like prescription drugs, and geez, if you go to the CVS and unwrap a package of even non-prescription drugs, over-the-counter drugs, you're going to see a bunch of government-required disclosures. But you'll see that those aren't on the front of the box, and you really can't see them until you pick it up. And, of course, those products are claiming that they're going to make you feel better and are healthy, and that claim needs to be qualified. And, of course we're nobody in the cigar and pipe tobacco industry is making that claim. So we really do think the FDA is overreached here, and we think that it's an opportunity to really provide some definition of the First Amendment restrictions on commercial disclosures.
Thanks, Mike. I have a feeling that Todd also thinks that the FDA could be overreaching as it pertains to the First Amendment. Todd, you have some unique First Amendment concerns when it comes to the harms to vaping clients. Can you discuss those? And perhaps if you're not finished discussing the harm reduction issue or angle, maybe touch on that a little bit more. And then after your remarks, we'll talk with our audience and see if they have questions.
Very good. Yeah, I think I can weave the points together because they are related. And I'll try to keep it short, my second response shorter so we can get to questions. Some of our First Amendment claims we do have in each of the three lawsuits that listeners can find on pacificlegal.org website are similar to the ones that Mike's brought. And let me give you one example. As of August, I think, we've got to label, our clients would have to label their vaping juices either that they contain nicotine, and that's, you know, somewhat, but some of them don't. Well, as to them, if you could get approval, you have to label that they are made from tobacco. Well, neither of those would be true. So they would have to pick an alternative that is 100% false. So that would be an example of how applied to our vaping clients, it compels one type of speech or another that both would be false. So some of their vaping products have zero nicotine, and that's their purpose. And some people like, you know, smoke, you know, vaporizing flavored, and they're not made from tobacco. But our First Amendment claim also has two somewhat different differences or variations. One is our clients are more concerned with the prior restraint on what they're able to say apart from these warnings. For example, a lot of them are in the business because they think it saved their lives, it helped them stop smoking. Their husband, in one case, died, and they went into the business to help save lives. But under this rule, any of our clients, even if they're small retailers, wanting to tell their own personal story would need FDA pre-approval. Well, as you know, any lawyer knows, a prior restraint on speech requiring government approval is pretty bad. Well, we emphasize another aspect that makes it even worse, and that is that the burden to prove the value of speech is on the speaker. And not only must the speaker prove that on balance the speech is, that the speech we want to give is a value, which is a very foreign thing in American jurisprudence, but we also have to show that it is more valuable than the harm that it may cause to all vapers, all users, and not any particular segment. Well, that's, first of all, that makes it almost impossible to prove. How do you prove something, you know, as a whole, as to everyone? But what if we only really want to market to smokers? What if our client's main message is, you know, it helped save my, you know, life, or help me quit smoking, try it and it'll reduce your smoking. But so the FDA's rule unconstitutionally shifts the burden to the speaker and creates a very, very difficult burden. So some of our clients have stopped even telling their own story. They're afraid of telling their story. And so they're afraid of A, saying what they think will help get customers, but and so it has a serious commercial impact, but it also stops them from doing the good. The FDA says the science isn't clear whether vaping might increase some, you know, first-time vapers to actually turn to tobacco, and that might be more harmful. The medical studies that I, you know, convince me personally that that's less likely to happen than the smokers would stop smoking and go to a more healthy or a less harmful product, vaping, that only has nicotine or eventually may have none. But in the situation where the science is unclear, and I think that's FDA's position, it can't make the speaker bear the burden to prove truth. The government has to bear the burden of proof, and perhaps the government can and did bear the burden of proof with regard to cigarettes. And so I'm not saying the government could never meet its burden of proof. We don't think the government could meet the burden of proof to ban most of the speech, most of the advertisements that our clients want, especially in this situation where it claims the science is still unclear whether vaping will lead to millions of lives saved or something in between.
Well, thanks, Todd, and thanks, Mike, for going along with me down the rosy path here. What we'll do now is turn to questions. In a moment, everyone on the call is going to hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode's been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter star and then pound on your telephone keypad. I'm going to open the floor now. Okay, the floor mode is on. If you'd like to request the floor to ask a question of either Mike or Todd, enter star and then pound on your telephone keypad. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, then you can ask your question. We'll answer questions in the order in which they're received. To get things started, I'd like to ask a question myself, Todd, because it's really interesting, the appointments clause issue that you've raised and the suits that you've recently launched. My question is, how often do agencies have their regulations issued by non-principled officers or signed off on by non-principled officers? And the question really is, I mean, how many rules are implicated by this issue, do you think?
We only have an idea, and we only have an idea within HHS. We've done some sort of spot checks at the Pacific Legal Foundation, and we've commissioned a study, so we of just HHS. So we hope to have more definitive answers. But my PLF colleague Tommy Berry and I published a Wall Street Journal op-ed that ran, I think, February 28th. If any of your listeners want to find it. Where we noted that the other big division of HHS is the Center for Medicaid and Medicare. They issue regulations that are at least as complex, actually some of them are much longer than FDA's most complex rules because they govern all of Medicaid and Medicare. And what we found out is that unless it's a technical correction, Center for Medicaid and Medicare almost always has its major rules signed by the Secretary of HHS. So not only could it have its own principal officer sign the rule, but it actually seeks to have the HHS Secretary. At FDA, as I said, almost all the major rules are signed by this associate commissioner who's an FES employee. So what we see within HHS itself is that something, I don't have the numbers exactly right, but something like 90% or more of the major rules of one division are signed by the Secretary of HHS, and 95% or more of FDA's rules are issued by employees. So what we know is that it can be done constitutionally, even within HHS, but for some reason it's not. And that's one of the things our lawsuit is seeking to prevent, but we're conducting further research. I suspect that maybe every other agency does it constitutionally, but we've done some spot checks, and we've found that there are at least some other divisions of some other agencies that have apparently delegated the authority lower. One of the reasons we chose FDA to begin this constitutional challenge is they actually had the delegation to this employee online. We can actually see what it looks like. In some other agencies, the delegations we may need to FOIA them. We don't necessarily know what they look like.
Well, it's incredible, at least what your surveys or your research has turned up to begin with. Could be, potentially devastating to the administrative state if your claims prevail. Okay. We've got questions pending. I want to remind everyone on the call, however, that if you have a question for either Todd or Mike, just enter star and then pound on your telephone keypad. Let me go to our first question now. Caller, when we get to your request, you'll hear a prompt and you can ask your question.
This is Richard Belzer, a member of the Working Group for Energy and Environment, but I have broader interests in particular on this. So I have a question regarding something a little bit less complicated than the constitutional issue. The Tobacco Control Act authorized FDA to deem other tobacco products, other products made from tobacco as tobacco products, but for vaping, what we have are products that are not made from tobacco. Can you comment on what FDA's legal analysis was that enabled it to deem something that wasn't made from tobacco as if it were made from tobacco?
Mike may know as much. This is Todd. Mike may know as much as I do, but I know there are other lawsuits pending on that issue. We've chosen not to delve that deeply into it, but I take your point, and we've had, you know, our clients have had the same concern. But Mike, are you more familiar with the language that FDA has twisted so as to deem a non-tobacco product to be the equivalent of a tobacco product?
You know, tobacco products are defined in the Act, and there are some other vaping cases out there. That's not what I do that have brought that issue up and challenged it. And I believe one of them is likely to go up on appeal here in Washington D.C. I think probably the reality is though that there's not a ton of high volume anyways vaping products out there that don't have some tobacco derivation. So I think that's probably why it hasn't been a significant topic in the vaping challenges to date. But you're absolutely right. I mean, for those products that really have no tobacco derivative content, it's a hard argument for the agency to make to say that it currently has authority over those. Now, you know, it's kind of pick your poison a little bit because and that wasn't an intentional pun, but the FDA probably has other authorities to go out after non-tobacco products. You recall that the whole reason that the Family Smoking Prevention and Tobacco Control Act came about is that way back in the 1990s, the 1996, the FDA promulgated a rule that just regulated cigarettes as a drug. It was essentially as a nicotine delivery mechanism. And what the Supreme Court said in the Brown and Williamson case is that they thought that was an elephant hiding in the mouse hole. That if Congress had meant to give the FDA regulatory authority over tobacco products in the Food, Drug, and Cosmetics Act, they would have said so, and those products were in existence at the time that was promulgated, that was passed, and they just thought that was a bridge too far, and so the Act amended the Food, Drug, and Cosmetics Act to provide authority over tobacco products, but, you know, I have a feeling that the FDA can get to the same place with regard to non-tobacco product vaping machines, which are new and certainly weren't in the contemplation of the Congress. You know, the Brown and Williamson arguments probably wouldn't apply to. They can get to the same place under other authorities if they were so inclined, and that may be one of the reasons why that's not exactly front and center in the fight against the deeming rule. But I'm speculating. I mean, I have no inside knowledge on that.
Well, thanks for your response, Todd and Mike, and thanks for the question, Rick. It was a question that I think was a bit of an elephant in the room. I've read about these products that, I mean, perhaps have some derivative relation to tobacco, but some that have absolutely no tobacco in it. It's sort of a curious thing. In any event, we'll get to our next question here in just a minute, but I'd like to make an announcement. The announcement is that tomorrow, Wednesday, April 4 at 12 o'clock noon, we'll discuss regulatory and legislative action on current hurdles to the deployment of self-driving vehicles on another Free Lunch podcast for the Regulatory Transparency Project. Our guests tomorrow are Ryan Hageman, he's the Director of Tech Policy at the Niskanen Center, and Jamie Boone, Senior Director of Government Affairs at the Consumer Technology Association. Again, that's a Free Lunch podcast call, just like this one, tomorrow, Wednesday, April 4th at 12 o'clock noon on legislative and regulatory action on current hurdles to deployment of self-driving vehicles. If anyone on the call has a question, you can enter star and then pound on your telephone keypad, and we'll get to your question in turn. Next caller, when we get to you, you'll hear a prompt, and then you can ask your question.
Vaporizing devices that I've used all my life, or my mother used, were the electric vaporizer that vaporized the air. And here in the Northeast, we have all kinds of things that introduce vapor into the air, including a coffee can sitting on the radiator. Does the FDA think that this rule encompasses that sort of vaporizer?
This is Todd. I don't think so. And one of my colleagues who studied the rule knows more than I think it's a particular type of products that essentially you hold. Some look like pens, some look like slightly larger, wider devices that hold more juice, which is the liquid, the informal name for the liquid. I think they've defined it in such a way to include those devices. But your question raises a larger point, which is just because it looks like smoke doesn't mean it should be regulated the same way as actual combustion. There are some products that do something in between, but for most of our clients, it's just the battery-powered device that vaporizes liquid.
But let's say somebody took the somebody whose asthma bothered them in really dry climates or dry homes. You know, inside a northeastern home with no vaporizing device, it could get down to 40-30% desert type humidities. And somebody might find relief with a vaporizing device that had no flavor, just vaporized water. How would the FDA deal with that? How does this rule affect?
If it's in one of these handheld devices, I think that's what it's attempted to regulate. So if it's the kind of vaporizer we put in my daughter's bedroom when she was a baby, I think that's still just regulated by some other alpha, maybe this CTSC. We can't get through life without, you know, all of these regulations. But I think FDA is attempting to in the deeming rule at least, regulate the handheld devices.
You might indicate that just water would be certainly overreaching with this rule.
Well,
sure.
I just intervene, Todd. You know, I think probably the answer to your question under this rule is, you know, it has to be a vaporizing device designed to convey nicotine. So the technical term under the rule is an acronym. It's an ENDS, which I believe is an electronic nicotine delivery system. So the reason why your water vaporizer isn't
indicated
right here is because there's no nicotine in it. It's not designed to convey it.
But you could use a device designed to convey nicotine to simply to convey water vapor.
You could, but I think it has to be designed to convey nicotine in the first instance to be covered by.
Sure,
that
the device, that, for example, my clients, you know, sell devices manufactured by others that can convey nicotine, but in fact, some of their juices contain no nicotine. So I didn't catch the caller's name, but you're right that even as applied to them, even as applied to those products, I suppose, there is regulation. under the deeming rule.
Well, thanks for that interesting question, and thanks for the responses, Mike and Todd. I have a question myself, but we're getting pretty close to the top of the hour, so I want to ask anyone who's on the call that still has a question that they haven't asked to go ahead and ring in now, hit star and then pound on your telephone keypad, and we'll get to you. Otherwise, we'll perhaps hear some final remarks from Todd and Mike. But here's my question. I want to kick it over to Mike because this is sort of within your wheelhouse, Mike. Are you aware of other commercial disclosure cases pending?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think probably the key one right now is the at the circuit level is the American Beverage case and American Beverage Association case in San Francisco. That case involves a San Francisco ordinance that required a health warning to be placed on 20% of any advertisement of a sugar-added beverage, and a panel of the United Circuit struck that down under the relaxed Zotterer framework for compelled commercial disclosures on two grounds. One, that it was unduly burdensome because it was too large. It was essentially overtaking the advertisement, becoming the principal message through its size and format. That's kind of exactly what we're talking about in the cigar warnings cases, and then second, that the message itself was controversial because there was an ongoing scientific debate about the health effects of sugar-added beverages, so that's a key case. That case, en banc review has been granted in that case. The court is holding it for the outcome of the Becerra case that was argued 2 weeks ago in front of the Supreme Court. And you know, that's another, not exactly a commercial disclosure case, but it raises all of these issues. That case concerns a California law that required family planning counseling services, mostly services that were counseling people against abortion to post a notice that abortions were available elsewhere. And you know, there's a large debate in front of the Supreme Court about what standards should apply there. But you know, I think we saw some hostility from many members of the court, including Justice Kennedy, about the circumstances under which the government can compel a company or a private person to carry, you know, its message. You know, another front on this issue is what's going on in California with regard to Proposition 65. That requires disclosures for any number of products that carry what they widely define as carcinogens, even in small levels. And there's been a number of cases striking down the requirement of that disclosure as applied to certain products. You know, this area of the law is one I think that is probably ripe for and headed to the Supreme Court of the United States. The circuits are divided on many of the requirements to get into this relaxed scrutiny for compelled commercial disclosures, including this really key issue about whether the disclosure needs to be aimed at correcting consumer deception. That's where the relaxed standard, that was the genesis of the relaxed standard in the Zotterer case. The Supreme Court, every opportunity it's had, has reinforced that it's looking for that purpose, and here the governments are reaching into all sorts of different products that where people aren't making any claims about whether they're good for you or bad for you, and the government wants to come in and say that they're bad, right? It's not meant to correct a misleading impression that some statement about the product's benefits might otherwise convey, and this will be a continuing front of regulation. Just about any product that the government doesn't have the political will to ban, but doesn't think you should be using very much of or at all, they're going to turn to these disclosure requirements, and they're going to start relatively modest, but at some point paternalistic regulator is going to decide that you're not making very good decisions with the information you've been provided, and despite the fact of survey evidence that you understand the risk of what you're doing, but you're choosing to do it anyways, they're going to start conveying their message louder and louder and louder. And of course, the government doesn't want to spend money on advertisements or, you know, public health messages or, you know, education campaigns. They want to make the product owner, you know, say their message, the government's message, louder and louder and louder. And we've seen that in tobacco. It's been struck down several times, struck down for cigarettes, struck down for in-store graphic warnings. Hopefully it'll be struck down with regard to cigars and pipe tobacco. Oddly, we have this situation now where the warnings for the premium cigars that people use infrequently are bigger than the warnings for cigarettes, where they're, you know, where there's lots of, you know, significant evidence of addiction issues and negative health effects. So this is going to be a front on the constitutional fight on First Amendment issues. I think we have a Supreme Court that wants to decide another one of these cases. I think a lot of the cases have come up recently. The warnings have been too small and, you know, relatively discreet, despite the fact they've been sued over and it's created some bad law. But big warnings like this, big warnings like the ones out in California, those are the type of cases that will end up going to the Supreme Court, and hopefully we'll get some more clarity about what the government can do in this field.
Well, thanks for humoring my my last question there, Mike. I don't see any other questions queued up, and that may be the case because we're so close to the 1 o'clock hour. Everyone's finishing their lunch and headed back to billing. You know, Mike and Todd, you raise a lot of really interesting issues. One of the things that I think about, not being a manufacturer of any of these things, although sympathetic to some of the things I've heard here, is that I'm potentially a consumer of some adult products, cigars or vaping products. I've heard recently some concerns in on the West Coast to carcinogens and coffee and some labeling that has to be now done on those products. This is really concerning that the atmosphere around purchasing these products or just shopping for these products sort of makes a consumer potentially feel like they're just a bad person engaging in any of that sort of adult activity, just the purchasing or the shopping for those products. So it's concerning on a lot of different levels. But in any event, we are close to the end of our call. I want to ask Mike and Todd if you have any closing remarks for or thoughts for our listeners. Either one of you?
Well, Devin, thank you. This is Mike Edney, and you know, I think you've absolutely hit the nail on the head in your concluding remarks. I mean, these disclosures are meant to make you not feel so great about yourself, but they're also meant to make you feel like you're, you know, not making an adult decision or that you're ill-informed. And when we're requiring these disclosures, despite evidence that the people that are using these products are understand what they're getting into and are choosing to do it anyways, but you know, the government becomes increasingly frustrated with those decisions. I think that kind of infantilization of the American public is where we run into problems in the First Amendment, and you see that in a number of Supreme Court cases, that theme, and I think it will be vindicated again at some point.
This is Todd. I was going to add something very similar, the coffee warning, which, again, you've invited us to comment on, and I don't know a lot on, except I heard a physician on the radio this weekend pointing out that we know that coffee reduces certain kinds of cancer. So if the government's of California's required warning causes people to reduce drinking coffee, that may have a negative health effect. Well, our vaping clients have a similar concern about the content of the rule. What we and they definitely know at the Pacific Legal Foundation is they violate the First Amendment and they violate the Appointments Clause, so they're unconstitutional. But even if we could cure, if the FDA reissued the rule in a constitutional manner under the Appointments Clause and fix the First Amendment problem, we'd also have a concern with the nanny state interfering with what appears to be a great harm reduction potential of vaping to reduce smoking harms from cigarettes, just because we think that there are some residual harms, and there are, from nicotine and other things in vaping products.
Well, fellas, this has been a wonderful teleform, and I thank both of you for participating. And as usual, I want to thank our audience also for tuning in. I hope that we'll see each other again tomorrow for our teleforum on self-driving cars, innovation, and regulation at noon. Until then, though, so long, everyone.
On behalf of the Federalist Society's Regulatory Transparency Project, thanks for tuning in to Free Lunch. As always, you can subscribe on iTunes and Google Play to get new episodes of Free Lunch when they're published. Also, visit our website at regproject.org. That's regproject.org. There, we regularly upload content in addition to our podcasts, such as short videos and papers. And you can join the discussion by sharing your story of how regulation has personally affected you. Until next time, remember, there's no such thing as a free lunch.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.